I'm the direct programmatic descendant of Walter Swingle because I'm involved in citrus breeding. Fortunately, so far, USDA does not have my annual performance expectations based on what Swingle did. So mine are going to be mainly a bunch of word charts. I do have some pictures scattered in, but I had a colleague when I was a graduate student who stood up for her first professional presentation, and she was silent for about a minute and a half. Ever since then, I've essentially written down everything I intend to say in a talk. So Swingle, later known as Tenny to his friends, was born in 1871 on a farm in Canaan Township, Pennsylvania. When he was 2 years old, due to farm failures that were widespread in the area, his family moved to Kansas, where he grew up on farms outside of Manhattan. By the age of 9, Swingle had sopped up the entire curriculum of his one-room schoolhouse. And I saw this in several places. I'm not sure if this goes back to an original source or it's just so pithy that every succeeding biographer included it. So after this, he was taught at home by his mother and helped with chores and explored the local plants. This was quite fascinating to me. If nobody could tell him what the plants were, he made up names for them. And he found out that there actually was a body of knowledge that would explain what their names were, and went to the nearby college and obtained a copy of Gray's Manual of Botany. And he taught himself to be a systemic botanist. In later life, Swingle commented that his unorthodox training was a major advantage for him, because formal schooling made students too regimented and standardized in their thinking. His intellectual stimulation may have also been enhanced by attending debates in Manhattan, and this is one of the few topics he recalled, resolved that wealth has more influence upon the central government than labor. It's a good thing that's not true today. Presumably these discussions contributed to his intellectual rigor. So at 15, Swingle began classes at the Kansas State Agricultural College, of course now Kansas State University. He was recognized for his lively intellect, asking questions previously unasked, such as, how long can a weed seed lie in a field before it sprouts? Why don't we try to get rid of weeds by introducing their diseases? And if we hybridize corn, when is the silk receptive to pollen? How long does it stay receptive? And this penchant for asking lots of questions stayed with him for his entire life. And there are some reports that I didn't include of him meeting with several people and just generating a wild profusion of ideas, and people, younger scientists who were with him, coming back saying, I'm going to become an idea man. This was an incredible experience. What we'll see here and in the next talk, I imagine, is that the lives of David Fairchild and Walter Swingle were quite intertwined. So David Fairchild's father was president of the Kansas State Agricultural College when Swingle attended, and he first met Swingle when he presented a paper on cereal crop rust at the age of 16. Fairchild was quoted, he gave me my first insight into the great intellect of Swingle. It was from him that I first heard the word bacteria. And with it, it opened the door for me into the world of microscopic organisms. Because he had taught himself to be a systemic botanist, at 17, he was appointed assistant botanist at the experiment station. And by the time he had finished his BS degree at age 20, he had published 27 papers, including 6 as the sole author. He was conferred, and what I'll be doing in my talk is not going in a historically linear manner, but following different threads of his life. So we'll continue to backtrack. It was just way too complicated to be able to follow a linear timeline. So much later, he was conferred an MS by Kansas State College in 1896 and the title of Doctor of Science in 1922, based not on his formal training, but his extraordinary contributions. So in 1891, just as he graduated from college, he was offered a position with the newly formed United States Department of Agriculture on the recommendation of David Fairchild. And this is repeated several times by various biographers. He was so young that his parents had to give their permission for him to take the job. And a big deal has been made about his starting salary of $1,400. But if you actually go back and figure out what that is in current dollars, it's not too bad for a starting salary with a bachelor's degree, $35,000 to $40,000 a year. So in 1891, his relationship with citrus began. He was sent to Eustis, Florida, to examine orange trees due to complaints by the orange growers of various diseases that were creating problems. He set up a lab. Fortunately, our current lab is a little different from this one, but this is the lab that he worked in. And the story goes that by 1894, he had solved many of the problems that the growers had identified. And with Herbert John Weber, down here in the lower right-hand corner, who established the citrus experiment station in California later, he began a citrus breeding program to breed new disease-resistant citrus trees as a longer-term solution. And the concept on which all of this work was based was that resistant traits from wild relatives would be the key to their success, hence his evolution into a plant explorer. So after the devastating freeze in 1894-1895, both Swingle and Fairchild went back to Europe to study extensively with some of the leaders in botany. This photograph is pretty widespread. So over here in the front left is David Fairchild, and in the front right, Walter Swingle. These are a couple of glamour photographs of him fairly early in his career. For some reason, USDA has not continued this tradition, just in case their researchers become famous. And I thought it was quite interesting that he apparently had the opportunity to spill far more than coffee on his papers, which most of us probably still do today, because it looked like he actually conducted experimentation. I was intrigued by this poster behind him and was able to track it down. It's calling for quarantine regulations. A group of California fruit growers were proposing to the state and federal officials to enact a law to prevent importation of trees infested with insects and fungal pests, including those horrible nurserymen in the eastern U.S. that were sending things that were just creating problems. He definitely made his mark in citrus breeding due to those freezes. Swingle directed crosses, and he appears not to have made many of the crosses himself. He instead was directing folks who worked with him to cross Pancirus trifoliata, which is essentially inedible, but is very cold hardy. Until recently, your terrible freeze a couple of years ago, there were trees growing in the National Arboretum of Pancirus trifoliata. Resulting plants included carrizo, which is a navel orange by Pancirus, which is the most important rootstock in California and second most important in Florida. So he wasn't trying to breed rootstocks. He was trying to breed scion varieties that would be cold hardy. But serendipity played a role even back then in how things developed. And he also produced what is now known as Swingle, which is a Duncan grapefruit by Pancirus, which is the most widely used citrus rootstock in Florida. So even though the initial crosses and certainly fruit from Swingle and Carrizo taste absolutely terrible, the citrus breeders are a stubborn lot and have continued to use Pancirus in the pedigree of material. And we have just submitted the paperwork for the first scion release that includes Pancirus and its pedigree. Further cold hardiness breeding was conducted using kumquat, which is the most cold resistant of highly edible citrus relatives, and gave rise to a category called limequats, Eustis and Lakeland, and he also created other, he just went crazy making crosses between all sorts of different species, and he created the new category known as Tangelo. Many of you probably know Mineola, also known as Honeybell Tangelo. That's probably the most famous scion release from the history of our program. And I have here in small letters all the other bizarre intergeneric and interspecific hybrids he made, which are for the most part just interesting. He's also considered the breeder for Murcott, which until recently was the most important Mandarin variety in Florida, and is the parent of Tango, which is taking the world by storm. And he also introduced the first clementines. Now, these are not the same clementines that are being grown now. They've made selections of seedless variants in Europe since then, and in North Africa. But this clementine was widely used as a parent. About half the scion releases from our program include clementine. I couldn't find any photographs of Swingle out in orange groves when he was a younger man and actually actively involved in citrus breeding. But here he is with his close collaborator, Ralph Robinson, examining some of the fruits of their labor. So he was, now once again I'm showing you a different thread. In 1897 and 88, Swingle and Fairchild established the USDA Office of Seed and Plant Introduction. They recognized the need for genetic diversity in crops and the risk of growing them in monocultures, very pressing. And he was an advocate for permanent living collections of economically important plants and their close relatives. So very much the father of the gene banks that we benefit from today. Another collaboration with Herbert John Weber, Swingle developed plans in 1897 to establish a subtropical laboratory in Miami, which is still, of course, operated by the USDA ARS today, and quite fittingly is just down the road from Fairchild Gardens and on Old Cutler Road. You should visit if you get the chance. So this was the first plant introduction station. They were joined by David Fairchild in 1898, and the trio were so enthused by the tropical diversity that they vowed to return to Miami at some point and work together on tropical plant development. Swingle was truly prescient in his use of wild relatives in breeding and rootstocks. He proposed testing all known wild relatives for disease resistance and other advantageous traits that could be introduced to improve citrus. This led him into his comprehensive study of citrus taxonomy, anatomy, and systematics and in the Orange family, and he completed this during his retirement at the University of Miami. So this, I thought, was really quite striking. He was a man who was thinking on a grand scale. In agreement with Liberty Hyde Bailey, Swingle proposed introducing all citrus relatives to a disease-free island in the Sea of Japan and taking material from that repository to test for all major citrus diseases. So here we follow the narrative thread of him as a plant explorer. In 1898, the USDA Office of Pomology paid his way to make a collection of good table grapes that might work out for California. He remained abroad for the next 2 years, traveling widely in Europe, North Africa, and Asia Minor. Before he went out on his travels, as plant explorers continue to do today, he drew up a list, with the help of David Fairchild, of the sorts of things that they were looking for. And the focus was crop plants suitable for the South, especially the Southwest. And that list included wine and raisin grapes, citrons, olives, pistachios, Smyrna-type figs, etc. So Fairchild and Swingle envisioned that a high-quality dessert date industry would do well in the U.S., and they sought cultivars to achieve this. So Swingle studied the varieties and cultural methods used in North Africa and published the first comprehensive monologue on date varieties and their culture. He introduced the Medjool and Deglet Noor dates, which remain by far the most important two date varieties in our date production in the U.S. So it's really quite fascinating. It's hard to capture this sort of life in 20 minutes, but the details of his explorations and importations are really quite fascinating and often include details that would not be included in a modern account. So it's quite interesting. One of the things that he took on as a task was to understand why Smyrna figs did not set a crop in the U.S. And he visited with the fig growers in Turkey and surrounding areas, and they had the practice of hanging capra figs in their Smyrna trees, which is still our practice today for Smyrna fig production. This, interestingly, was dismissed by the scientific authorities as mere superstition, but Swingle was not satisfied with the superstition explanation, and he later ensured the success of fig culture by introducing the Blastophaga wasp that's critical for pollination of Smyrna figs. A lot of details here. These are just some of the examples. You can probably read even faster than I can talk, so you may get a little bit of this. And Swingle was certain that the Salton Sea area would harbor a thriving date industry, and at his insistence, USDA established the date garden near Mecca, California, later moved to Indio, California, and now unfortunately shut down as a USDA facility. And for many people, Swingle is best known for introducing date palms. And I found one little blurb indicating that he actually, as some scientists will do, decided to take his interests and make them commercial, and he owned a commercial date garden in Indio. Here are a few photographs relating to dates. The manager of the date station in 1925, and a photograph showing the entrance to what became the date and citrus station in India. So, how many people here have ever gone on Grin? Probably most of you. So, of course, that's a fabulous database for all the germplasm that USDA has in their various collections. There's a little tab you can click that says include historical accessions. And if you do that, you come up with 2,054 accessions with Walter Zwingli as the collector. It's a little bit fuzzy in the original PI records, which delightfully you can click on the accession page in Grin for many accessions. Some things were specifically collected by him and others received through and some donated by. So perhaps similar to Hansen, the comment could be made that in some cases he got his material from other people that had collected them. The list is enormous for the things that he looked at. You can see here in this paragraph the broad diversity. That's the downside of using the mouse as the pointer. You can see the broad diversity of crops he worked on. Of course, also lots of fruit and nut crops, which interest us most in the American Pomological Society. Of the 2,054 accessions, fewer than 84 are not historical. And this, to me, really underscores the importance of the National Plant Germplasm System, because this diversity has been lost. And, of course, that is our first charge in the National Plant Germplasm System, to maintain this broad diversity of material. And at this point, Robert Kruger shared with me that there are 16 accessions in the National Citrus Germplasm Repository for citrus and dates. Here are a few details of his personal life. Sometimes these people seem larger than life, and they are, but they're not just scientific machines. They're also human beings. As a teenager, the Zwinglis were not as bent on moral reform as were their fellow Kansans. And even though Kansas went dry in 1880, Pa and I gathered grapes in the wood, and he made us wine. He gets even more points from me for that aspect. We went on leave, as I said, going to Europe in 1898. And while in Europe, he met his future wife, Lucy Rumstadt, who was his French tutor, and they married in 1901. And this to me was quite intriguing, and this goes in great depth in various writings. The first Mrs. Zwingli was a stylish socialite, expecting parties, furs, jewels, and other manifestations of high living. She accompanied him on his travels, staying in grand hotels, and they soon became deeply in debt. They ordered vintage wines, more points for me, and from all of us, fruit out of season, always looking for something exciting and new. She died of typhoid, unfortunately, in 1910, and after her death, it's reported that Zwingli lived quite frugally, renting a room from other people in order to pay off his debts, which he, of course, did. In 1911, Zwingli became reacquainted with botanist Maud Kellerman, who was the daughter of his old professor at Kansas State, and she came to Washington, D.C. They were married and had four children who were successes in their own right. But this is not enough. Botany is not simply enough for Zwingli. He had very broad intellectual interests. He recognized that in the U.S., it was not the hotbed of scientific research, and he would need to learn either French or German. What I read was he was not satisfied with the German he could get from classes and instead went to the German immigrant who fed the pigs at Kansas State Agricultural College and learned to speak German, which permitted him to go to Europe and study with Strasburger, who had theorized that chromosomes were carriers of heredity, and Zwingli conducted cytological studies that proved the existence of citrosomes in plant cells. I haven't found any details on what he was doing exactly in Naples, but he occupied the Smithsonian chair at the Marine Zoological Institute in Naples. Later in his career, relating to botany and agriculture, he developed a heat therapy method to divest date palm offshoots from scale insects. This was critical for them to be able to import this material into the U.S. And being a pretty clever guy, when they first introduced the date offsets, they actually planted them in a little corner of Nevada right next to California because they would not have been permitted into California until they were verified as being free of pests. He demonstrated that Deglet Noor will not ripen fruit unless bunches are thin. This was another case of serendipity. He had actually bagged bunches and was control pollinating some of them. And what he learned was even those that were not pollinated set crops because of the bunches being smaller, and that of course is now a standard practice in date production, is to for fruit size as well as good set. He made hybrids between different phoenix species, different dates and relatives, and found that the seed characteristics were affected by interspecies pollination. He proposed the term metazenia, which we all know, of course, and apparently this created quite an uproar, similar to the uproar that Barbara McClintock made in first introducing us to transposable elements. And he showed that citrus grown from new cellar seedlings were rejuvenated due to the fact that the seeds are being freed of viruses, which is still used in citrus production today as a way of, because it's highly apomictic, as a way to introduce more vigorous variants. So I've already used my 20 minutes, so I'm going to go through here pretty quickly. Swingle first became interested in Chinese literature as a result of his work on citrus. He learned to speak and read Chinese, and he was given a budget by the Library of Congress to collect materials during his plant exploration trips, and he obtained over 100,000 volumes. And he later also translated material from Chinese into English, as well as literature from Japan, Korea, and Mongolia. This would not happen today, but apparently even though he was a great scientist, someone decided he should become an administrator, and he was not very good at it. So I was particularly amused by the fact that his bosses were staggered by the scope of his proposals, such as the one to introduce all of citrus relatives to a disease-free island. So his biographer, Venning, stated, Swingle's career in one short phrase was an astonishing accomplishment accompanied by increasing frustration. So a great scientist, but not so great as an administrator. After his retirement from the USDA, which at that point was obligatory at the age of 70, he moved to Miami, joining David Fairchild, as they had agreed many years before when they had first started out in their careers. He was given support by the University of Miami and completed his monograph on the botany of citrus and its relatives, which remains the premier reference for taxonomy and anatomy today. Swingle continued to be highly productive. By the end of his career, he had over 250 scientific articles. He inspired a generation of students with his knowledge, curiosity of nature, and insight into plants. And his simple advice to students, I love this quote, was look and look again and again, which are words still relevant today. He passed away in 1952, and there's this photograph of him just a few months before his death. So what is his legacy? In addition to helping found USDA plant germplasm collecting and conservation, and there was critical material that he himself collected, he's remembered in several other ways. His treatise on the taxonomy of citrus at the University of Miami today is a Swingle plant anatomy reference collection with several thousand digitized microscopic images. Swingle discovered dozens of new species and new genera in the citrus family, and he's listed as the taxonomic authority on many. And the genus Swinglia was named in his honor, another genus in the citrus group. And the most important citrus rootstock in Florida is named after him and is known as Swingle. So I've used just a couple of minutes more than my time. This was a real treat. Rob Griesbach tells me he's got piles and piles of photographs and letters and other information relating to Swingle. So I'll actually be able to make this far more complete when it's published in the proceedings.